Some say that that's a bug, or it could also be a feature. So my perspective is that Bitcoin's stubborn simplicity is its strength and also its curse.
Get ready to jumpstart your week with the FCAT Crypto Brief, brought to you by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology. Join us as we delve into the hottest topics, from blockchain breakthroughs to DeFi revolutions and market happenings. We promise to go deeper than the headlines and deliver market insights you can't get just anywhere. Be sure to hit subscribe for your bi-weekly dose of crypto commentary. Quick disclaimer, we're here for education, not investment advice. Views expressed are of the hosts, not Fidelity or its affiliates. Crypto's a wild space, highly volatile, can become illiquid anytime, and is strictly for those with a high risk tolerance. Buckle up, enjoy the ride, and let's dive into what's been happening recently.
All right. Welcome, everybody, to the 100th episode of Crypto Brief.
It's a big day. Happy Friday, everyone.
Gotham, I thought we were going to do the BitConnect. What's up? Good to see you guys. How are you all?
Doing really well.
Yeah, doing really well. We're celebrating 100 episodes, which is super exciting. Also coming off the back of Crypto Week in DC. So that's exciting as well. I think there's a lot to talk about.
I can't believe that you skipped any kind of annotation to the price of Bitcoin, which has moved significantly. We are at Bitcoin all-time highs with the 100th episode. Bitcoin sitting at 120 now.
Yeah, I know. You're right. I should have called that out. I feel like I've just celebrated every day this past week. So I'm a little bit over-celebrated maybe at this point. Well, welcome everyone. Thank you for joining us. In this episode, I'm joined by Parth, David, and Gotham. And as Gotham mentioned, with great excitement, we're actually celebrating 100 episodes of the Crypto Brief today. So we've got a pretty exciting episode for you. We're going to cover some of the many developments across the crypto landscape since we actually started back 3 years ago in 2022. However, before we jump into that, as I mentioned, it was a big week in DC with Crypto Week in Washington. Dave, do you want to cover a little bit of what we saw this week?
Sure. So the U.S. House passed three crypto bills yesterday. The Genius Act, the Clarity Act, and an anti-central bank digital currency bill that would block the Fed from issuing a CBDC directly to individuals. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Genius Act and Clarity Act, and then maybe we can opine a little bit on them. So the Genius Act, it actually stands for Guiding and Establishing National Innovation for U.S. Stablecoins. And it basically establishes a regulatory framework for stablecoins. It states that issuers must be a subsidiary of an insured depository institution, which basically means a bank, or they must be a federal qualified non-bank issuer or a state qualified non-bank issuer. So issuers can choose if they want to be a federal or state regulated issuer, but if the market cap of your issued stablecoins is below $10 billion, you have to go the state route. So the federal regulators won't really talk to you until you pass that $10 billion market cap mark. It also mandates annual audits for issuers whose outstanding stablecoins issued have a market cap of more than $50 billion. And it sets rules for reserves. Obviously, your stablecoins have to be backed one-to-one with U.S. cash or cash equivalents. It states that stablecoins are not considered securities under securities law, but issuers are still subject to Bank Secrecy Act for anti-money laundering and related purposes. So this bill has already passed in the Senate, and it is now with the president where it is expected to be signed. Next is the Clarity Act. So the Clarity Act establishes a regulatory framework for digital commodities. It really defines what a digital commodity is, and it says that the CFTC must regulate digital commodities transactions, which includes exchanges, brokers, and dealers. So to qualify to trade on a CFTC-regulated exchange, the native assets blockchain must be mature and decentralized, as defined by the bill. The bill also establishes exchange requirements for trade monitoring, record keeping, and the commingling of customer assets. So that is your FTX influence.
That's so timely because it's actually close to 3 years since the FTX collapse and the whole Terra Luna fiasco happened. So it's just, it tells you the maturity we have had in the last 3 years. And when I think about the three bills, and I know, you know, we'll cover all three of them, it just, it blows my mind because there's a lot of cognitive disbelief when I think about what was happening in 2022 with all the bankruptcy claims and cut to now when you have the Genius Act focused on stablecoins. Maybe, Dave, a question to throw in here is that 80% of stablecoin transactions happen outside of the US. So do you think something like this, something like the Genius Act would kind of bring that in? Do you think that we'd be able to successfully set the standard, or is this just playing catch up to the MiCA framework?
I think it will. So I think that it will make US-based institutions a lot more comfortable to engage with stablecoins, and that should bring up the volumes within the US.
I mean, maybe another interesting question here as well is that you do have to be a US-based issuer, correct? So in the case of the largest stablecoin issuer, Tether, it's a bit of an open question as to what they're going to do to try and maintain their US presence.
So Genius does set rules for foreign issuers to issue to US people, but it doesn't look like Tether will be compliant with those rules. So if Tether wanted to become compliant, they would have to change the composition of their reserves or launch a new product to exist just in the US for US people. So we'll see. Just finishing up on the Clarity Act here, it exempts digital commodities on mature blockchains from SEC registration requirements if the annual sales fall under a certain amount and requirements are met. And Clarity is on its way to the Senate, where it seems likely to pass, but I can't say for sure. So, you know, looking at these, my question's really like, you know, they define what a mature blockchain is. And, you know, they say things like, if it's been operational for 12 months, is it decentralized, meaning no single person or group has unilateral control over the network? Does it have a secure consensus mechanism? And like, is it publicly accessible, allowing any person to read, write, or audit? It will be interesting to see how these things hold up over time.
Dave, I'm kind of glad that we're also going to touch or talk about the evolution of blockchains in the last 3 to 4 years towards the end of this episode, which I think is going to be fascinating. And that will be a good full complete circle. Maybe, Matt, if you want to shift gears here, one interesting observation that I've made especially more so in the last 2-3 weeks has been just around tokenized stocks. Now, tokenization itself comes with a negative connotation because people first started saying that out loud in 2017, 2018. And then we saw, you know, a few ups and downs. And initially it started out with tokenization is going to eat the world. And it's kind of been a recurring theme for the last 3 years, but we're no way close to that. But I do feel like what I've seen in the last 1 month, and I'd be bold enough to say that we are probably at step one in that 1-to-100 journey. So maybe, Matt, if you think it's a good idea, maybe we can switch gears and talk about tokenization.
Yeah, I think that's great. Do you want to just jump into it?
Yeah, so maybe let's start out with the Robinhood story. So last week, Robinhood announced that they are coming up with a new tokenization chain called the Robinhood chain, which is, you know, a great, great name, very, very creative, where they'll do tokenized US stocks on their own blockchain. And right now it's available for European users. Now, what's interesting about this is they're initially starting out with a lot of the stocks that you already know. But eventually, they're also going to add SpaceX and OpenAI, which are pre-IPO stocks that you can trade on the Robinhood app. Now, the current provision is that you can trade these pre-IPO stocks or, you know, these private stocks 24/5, and then eventually it'll get to 24/7. So at some point, and here's the most interesting part to me, at some point they have it as part of their phased approach. You can potentially take these tokenized stocks off of Robinhood, put it directly to the Robinhood chain, and go do DeFi stuff like lending, yield farming with your tokenized stocks. And, you know, I think there's a few caveats and there's a few challenges to getting to that path. But I think having a big name like Robinhood, there's been a few other initiatives by Kraken and eToro specifically focused on tokenizing stocks to get them 24/7, you get more accessibility. Those are the initiatives which I think are completely new and also refreshing to see in the last 3-4 months.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think maybe something that would be helpful to double click on is maybe how we've thought about tokenization over the past 3-4 years and how it's changed, because it feels like it's been a bit of a moving target. And now maybe we're finally starting to define what we actually mean.
Well, I think that's a really good point. So if I go back in 2022, if you go back 3 years, it's 2022, crypto is in a deep freeze. You had the FTX collapse, you had Terra Luna blow up, Celsius, Three Arrows, they were all going bankrupt and no one really cared about tokenization at that point of time. I believe Securitize was fairly mature and they had a tokenization engine with a few big collaborations here and there. In 2022, you had a few startups where they were tokenizing real estate and you know, soon enough, some real estate in Miami, some real estate in different parts of the US. And then soon enough, people realized that there's just maybe 2 dozen people who get excited about fractional rental income through tokenization. So it's 2022. The banks don't touch it. The banks won't touch it. The regulators weren't too happy about it. And then frankly, the collapse itself just scared off the investors. Now, I think in 2023 is when we were trying to, that the vibe was shifting. Crypto market cap had doubled. And it was around this time in May when the EU came out with the MiCA framework, just focusing on clearer rules. And that's when you see a lot of the CEOs talk about, a lot of mainstream CEOs talk about tokenization eating the world. Something along the lines of tokenization would cover every stock, every bond. And Franklin Templeton expanded their tokenized money market fund across different chains. So that's when 2023 was when people felt that tokenization could possibly be a thing. So I think we had a fairly shaky start in 2022. And now, you know, we do, the last time I checked on DeFi Llama or just RWA.xyz, I believe we have an $18 billion market of tokenization of real world assets. So we have come a long way.
Yeah, I mean, that's a massive difference from 2022, right? Like you mentioned tokenization in 2022 and I think everyone would just leave the room.
Yeah.
Besides maybe a few people.
Yeah, exactly. And what's also, not to digress too much, but what's also interesting is that you have companies which are also trying to build this super financial services app. They have the distribution, they have the hold on Gen Z and millennials, the next age, the new age customers. And they're literally doing so many financial services like trading, banking. I think they also have retirement products now. And so it's no longer just buying or selling Bitcoin. So you see that change in the last 3 years. And now obviously they're adding tokenized stocks with the latest announcement. I don't know if you all got a chance to look at on the Coinbase side, Coinbase just came out with the Base wallet. So they deprecated their Coinbase wallet and now they have a new Base wallet and it's completely, there's a lot of rebranding and this Base app behaves so differently than you would expect any other crypto app. Like it has single tap features, which bring you to Farcaster. That's the decentralized social media. You have a page to trade. You have a page to send money, add funds of USDC with Apple Pay. It's got a chat feature to talk to your friends. And they also have these videos on the Base app. So you're seeing that maturity of a lot of these crypto first applications. And now they're trying to go and be as mainstream and get to the real world.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a great point. I did see the TikTok style videos and I was like, you can't get away from it. It's everywhere. But it is an interesting transition away from just like a wallet or just a crypto platform, so more of an all-encompassing platform. And I think it really signals a lot of maturity in the industry. It's a really good call out. But with that, maybe we transition to the evolution of chains. I think that plays in really nicely. Gotham, do you want to give us a bit of an overview on that topic?
Yeah, definitely. And it's really funny because I was actually listening to a lot of the older episodes of Crypto Brief and how we were talking about like the merge like back in 2022. But yeah, I mean, you're starting to see this going back to Ethereum with this like consensus shift, right? Where, you know, Ethereum is switching from proof of work to proof of stake back in 2022, right? And how like there's a lot of slashing with energy, right? At least like 99% of it, right? But then you're also starting to see like, you know, throughput kind of largely unchanged, which led to a lot of layer two growth, right? So you see a lot of these layer twos or, you know, rollups like Optimism and, you know, Arbitrum One that pop up, right? That go live and then, you know, start basically doing a lot of these transactions off chain, right? Hopefully cutting, you know, gas fees and like boosting like TPS essentially. And then as you go into like 2023, you start to see a lot of, you know, the evolution of that with like universal messaging. So like messaging levels like cross-chain, ZK, you know, rollups on mainnet. So something like ZK Sync era and like the Starknet Alpha era in like 2023, which offers like withdrawal finality and then like massive throughput without sacrificing security. And then the big one, which I think we've kind of like been kind of alluding to this a little bit, is like with abstraction, like with like account abstraction. So like kind of like, you know, trying to introduce these like smart contract wallets where you natively on L1 with like gas abstraction, you know, meta transactions and, you know, social recovery as well. So I think we're starting to see this trend where it's like you've got like all of these like, you know, DeFi related like features, and then they're slowly starting to like kind of abstract a little bit where you're going more into like TradFi a little bit, or like more from like a more friendlier user experience. And then you've got 2024 with like the Pectra upgrade, right? With, you know, Haleski and like Sabella, you know, they're running these account abstraction improvements. So yeah, again, we're seeing like a lot of UX just getting smoother, and then like, you know, gas getting reduced a little bit more, at least hoping to. It's just interesting to see the progression over the years, how much it's really changed. I think there's been a lot of good with like, again, energy reduction and management, but also I feel like a lot of things that can be kind of improved on in terms of like scalability. Like I feel like we still have this problem of a lot of like layer twos, right? Addressing layer ones, right? But I mean, that's basically on the Ethereum side. And I'm curious to hear what you all have thoughts on for that.
Well, Gotham, what I would do, I'd say Bitcoin, ETH, and Solana have just followed this divergent technical paths from 2022 to now, each almost picking their own swim lane. So you think about stability, you think about innovation and decentralization. Like you said, in 2022, ETH was massively criticized for the energy consumption. I don't know if you guys remember, but 2022, there was just these massive campaigns where people would say, well, what's the point of doing this? And you're taking energy away and not doing anything useful with it. You had slow transaction speed. And when I think about the merge, you know, that obviously happened 3 years ago. And to me, sometimes it feels like it happened 10 years ago. So this, you know, it's one of those things which there's so much progress which has happened. But one of the big downsides, especially in the ETH ecosystem, has been just this shift into more fragmented liquidity, where you have DeFi applications struggle to interoperate seamlessly. So you have the same asset, which is now spread across different L2s, and there's no viable way to get from one place to another, right? Without having a lot of trust assumptions. Solana, on the other side, was this darling high-speed blockchain. You know, they spoke about thousands of transactions per second, but then you just had so many outages in the last 4 years. And that also kind of exposed its central core, where it's just a handful of validators controlling a lot of the network. And then again, 2022 is when you had the FTX collapse. So that became a forced wake-up call to Solana to rebuild its validator base. So a lot of people might say that Solana's obsession with just speed may come at the cost of the chain itself being resilient. And then you have Bitcoin, which is the same old reliable tank. It's secure, it's decentralized, painfully slow, and also, you know, fairly energy intensive. Matt can obviously talk more about how much energy Bitcoin takes, but some also say that that's a bug, or it could also be a feature. So my perspective is that Bitcoin's stubborn simplicity is just its strength and also its course. Matt, I'd love to get your thoughts on the energy side of things.
Yeah, certainly. Well, I think like first on the Bitcoin side, I think it's maybe helpful to think about the blockchain trilemma where you have, you know, security, decentralization, and scalability. And Bitcoin has just like fully maximized on the security and decentralization side, like to the utmost expense of the scalability. But that just, that is what it was designed to do. That was the original thought process. You know, the scripting language behind Bitcoin is very limited intentionally just to maximize the security of the chain. And these other chains have gone about, you know, thinking about that trilemma differently. And I think that it's just interesting to see all of the different strategies play out. And I think it's a matter of trade-offs, not a matter of right and wrong. But as far as on the energy side, you know, I think back to 2017, even before we started this podcast, you know, DigiEconomist came out and said that by 2020, Bitcoin was going to use more electricity than the entire United States. That obviously did not come true. Was a bit similar to like a Malthusian argument of kind of just looking at linear growth of population, not taking into account other constraints. But Bitcoin certainly does, you know, as a proof of work chain, uses a significant amount of energy. You know, if you look at the CCAF, they estimate that Bitcoin uses around 191 terawatt hours annually, which is a large amount of energy, certainly.
Now, do you remember in 2021, there was this high profile incident when you had the Texas blackout and that got exacerbated by crypto mining locally? So there has been, you know, a few instances where there's not been a lot of support around Bitcoin mining, especially because it takes away energy from other places.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think actually I would push back on the notion that the blackout was exacerbated by Bitcoin mining. There was media pushback on Bitcoin miners in Texas because as the grid, you know, essentially went through a massive grid shortage event, Bitcoin miners who were on demand response programs were asked by the grid operator to turn off and then were actually paid for providing that ancillary service. That is a program that the grid offers to maintain stability of the grid such that like flexible load customers, when they don't need the load, they can be incentivized to turn off by the grid to provide that load elsewhere. So it was certainly not a popular perception, did not look good that these Bitcoin miners were being paid while the rest of the like, grid prices were $1,000 a megawatt hour and people couldn't get power. But actually by turning off, they did provide a service to the grid and did help provide more electricity to a grid that was deeply strained. I think the more present story or a more timely story around energy consumption and Bitcoin mining has actually been the transition to AI and HPC. You know, we are now seeing massive data center demand. And actually, in the US, load growth for electricity has been flat for the past two decades. We are now anticipating and seeing a massive increase in load on the grid. So by 2030, it's expected that the total data center load on the grid will double, which is just a massive change for a sector that moves relatively slowly. Utilities are also pursuing $29 billion in rate hikes for consumers during the first half of 2025 to fund grid upgrades for both generation and transmission. Now, these rate increases are subject to approval from public utility commissions, but it is one of the biggest potential rate increases that we've seen. And that actually connects directly back to Bitcoin mining, because what we're seeing is that large grid-scale Bitcoin miners are now almost in direct competition for power with these large AI and HPC providers. And any hyperscaler will outbid a Bitcoin miner 10 times out of 10, just because Bitcoin miners are so price sensitive. You know, I think the best way to think about Bitcoin's electricity usage is it's most effective to use electricity that no one else wants. And so we're seeing firms like Galaxy, Core Scientific was just purchased by CoreWeave, and Riot was just paused a huge expansion to evaluate AI and HPC. So we're seeing a shift away from these really large grid scale infrastructure projects for Bitcoin mining, as those are just much more economically valuable to AI data centers, and more towards stranded energy that no one else really has a use for. So it might be at a smaller scale. It might be curtailed renewables. You know, we've certainly done research and looked into proof of concepts using solar. So stranded solar that the grid doesn't have a use for. And then also providing those demand response programs back to the grid. So it's been a massive change, you know, over the past 3 years, as we think about both the network security and the energy usage, but also the strategies of Bitcoin miners.
Matt, if you look outside the US, when you think about a country like China, how do you think about their supply and demand dynamics? Because I, as far as I remember, China's total electricity generation is around 3,000 gigawatts, which is approximately three times of what we do in the US. The US probably stands at around 1,200 gigawatts. How does that, and again, keep in mind that China pre-2021, because I know we are doing the last three-year horizon, pre-2021 was responsible for 60% of Bitcoin mining. And then they had the mining ban in 2021. And so they went from 60% to zero. And so how does that affect things if you think about outside the US?
Yeah, certainly. So I think the first thing I would say is that there's certainly more than 0% mining in China. It's really hard to say, you know, what percentage of network hash rate currently exists in China, but it could be zero, you know, one, it could be 20. We don't really know. But I think just from like thinking about first principles and economic inputs, right? Like one of the lowest form and most important economic inputs for any society is electricity. It is the conversion of energy, chaotic energy, into useful energy, higher order energy. And so as we see China really ramp up their electricity generation, it should be a bit of a warning sign for the US, I think, to think about what we need to do for our electrical infrastructure. You know, we both China and the US are going to be building a large amount of data centers and are going to have a large amount of electrical demand. And ultimately, who develops the strongest AI models, it may come down to who has the most available electricity. And I also think it's important to think about how more electricity generation and availability improves the lives of just the daily lives of Americans and humans around the globe. Everyone uses electricity. Everyone pays for electricity. The cheaper your electricity, the lower your electricity bill. You know, you can save that money. Or if you're out trying to do quantum computing, you know, high energy use scientific research, it makes all of these things cheaper and can actually be very important in advancing society. So maybe a bit off topic for the crypto brief, but I think it all ties together.
That's fantastic. I think I saw a projection where they said in 2030, there's an estimate that 8% of global electricity will be consumed by data centers in the next 5 years. And you already see that happening with a lot of these tech giants scrambling for power in the electricity sense and striking direct deals with nuclear and gas providers. So some of that is already shaping up now.
Oh yeah, it certainly is. And I mean, that's why some of these larger Bitcoin miners have shifted away from Bitcoin mining. Hyperscalers have a more economically driven need for that electricity and will pay more than Bitcoin miners will.
Yep. Yeah. Matt, I quickly want to digress, and I think there's an important fact which I forgot to mention on the Robinhood story of tokenizing shares. I think we put a pretty fairly optimistic view to it, but there are some caveats to the demo that was shown by Vlad at the Cons ETHCC event. And so if you recall, so Vlad announced tokenized shares for OpenAI and SpaceX, and they actually also offered $5 for people who would sign up for these tokens, who are eligible users. And this was his signal to just tokenize private markets. He was, you know, he called that out. However, soon after, 2 days after, OpenAI issued a statement. And so I just want to point out the other picture, which is not super rosy. OpenAI issued a statement saying, well, these OpenAI tokens do not represent any OpenAI equity. And so people were concerned if these OpenAI tokens comply with any of the investor protection rules. And so then, you know, as a response, the Robinhood CEO was defending the initiative where he said, well, these tokens are not direct equity, but they effectively give some kind of retail exposure to private markets. Since Robinhood owns an SPV, which is a special purpose vehicle that owns equity in OpenAI. So it's an indirect way of getting exposure to their retail customers. The SPV entity is owned by Robinhood, and that entity has equity in OpenAI. So not all things are rosy. Again, this could be, for all you know, a great, amazing way to talk about tokenizing the private markets as almost as marketing, not in a gimmicky way, but what can be done in the next 2 to 3 years. So I do want to be cautiously optimistic around just tokenization of private markets.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a great call out and an important piece of the story, because the OpenAI response came relatively quickly on the heels of the Robinhood response. And I think that there was a bit of uncertainty in the market surrounding like what is actually going on here. Well, we certainly covered a lot today. I think it'd be helpful to kind of go around the horn and just give a few minutes of like key takeaways from everyone, you know, what you think is important that's changed in the past 3 years, and maybe what's something that our listeners should look out for on the horizon.
Sure, I'll go first. So obviously, you know, the regulatory picture changing and getting set rules of the road in the US is really important. And one thing that I'm really interested in looking to the future is what tokenized assets see success when they come on chain. So there's been this long running sort of theory in the blockchain space that if you take illiquid assets like real estate or private market instruments and you bring them on chain, that those will translate into successful blockchain products. But what's really happened is the most liquid assets, whether it's treasuries or cash, have been the tokenized assets that have seen the most success on chain and by far the widest adoption. So what I'm looking at going forward is, will this trend continue? Will the most liquid assets, whether it's gold or mega caps, will those products, or even like an S&P index, will those see great success when they come on chain because they are the most liquid assets? Will that trend ultimately continue?
I can go next. So, you know, it's kind of funny just kind of reviewing like that a lot of this happened in the 3 years in regards to like all these chains sort of evolving, or some of them kind of like sporadically going to different routes of their evolution. But yeah, I can only kind of say from what was there before, and that, you know, I think we're going to see a lot more, you know, addresses to efficiency, you know, a lot more EIPs, as well as like other proposals for Bitcoin and Solana. I hope that in the future that there'll be more tackling on scalability. I think that's like a really big issue that needs to be addressed there. I think we'll also see like a lot more abstraction as we keep going more and more into the future of these chains, as well as crossover with TradFi, like a lot more, as we're seeing with like tokenization.
I'd say I'm excited about DeFi protocols and how resilient they are once you have true assets coming into those protocols. When you think about DeFi protocols, or supposedly the blue chip DeFi protocols like Aave, Curve, Uniswap, all these decentralized applications, they have been in this bubble where they have been the only assets which are on those are essentially all crypto assets. So think about your Pepe coins, Wrapped Bitcoin, Wrapped whatever assets. And so you'll truly test if they work when you start putting tokenized stocks as part of these DeFi protocols. And that's when you'll also have super sophisticated users coming in and not just crypto folks who like playing with perps.
Yeah, those are all good ones. I think I'm going to stay on brand as a Bitcoin miner and just say, I'm excited to see Bitcoin mining continue to develop as a great resource, as a flexible asset. I think that it will be very beneficial to grids in the future to continue to absorb and then turn off when electricity is needed. And then also continue to see Bitcoin mining monetizing stranded energy in really interesting ways. So things like flared gas mining, mining on curtailed renewables, and really kind of being the parasite of energy production and just buying up cheap energy that no one else wants to help secure the network. I think that's really exciting and really interesting to see. But I think with that, we can wrap up. Thank you everyone for joining us today. Thank you to Parth, David, and Gotham for an awesome conversation. And thanks everyone for joining us. We'll see you again on our next episode in 2 weeks.
Crypto as an asset class is highly volatile, can become illiquid at any time, and is for investors with a high risk tolerance. Crypto may also be more susceptible to market manipulation than securities. Crypto is not insured by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation or the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Investors in crypto do not benefit from the same regulatory protections applicable to registered securities. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. This podcast was produced by the Fidelity Center for Applied Technology, also known as FCAT. FCAT does not offer digital assets nor provide clearing or custody of such assets. It is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide tax, legal, insurance, or investment advice, and should not be construed as an offer to sell, a solicitation of an offer to buy, or a recommendation for any security or other asset by any Fidelity entity or third party. Views expressed are as of the date indicated, based on the information available at the time, and may change based on market or other conditions. Unless otherwise noted, the opinions provided are those of the authors and not necessarily those of Fidelity Investments or its affiliates. Fidelity does not assume any duty to update any of the information. Fidelity and any other third parties mentioned in the podcast are independent entities and are not affiliated. Mentioning them does not suggest a recommendation or endorsement by Fidelity. This information is not intended for distribution to or use by any person or entity in any jurisdiction or country where such distribution or use would be contrary to local law or regulation. Persons accessing this information are required to inform themselves about and observe such restrictions. Third-party trademarks appearing herein are the property of their respective owners. All others are the property of FMR LLC. Copyright 2025 FMR LLC. All rights reserved. 1040156.